Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Leslie Kernison with the Better Health While Aging podcast. So again, no music today because we are again doing something a little different with the podcast, which is I am going to be sharing the audio recording of a live Q&A webinar that we did this week for the readers of Better Health While Aging. We did it to answer people's questions about aging health during COVID times. So we do also have the video available on the site, although we don't particularly have any slides or visuals. So if you like to see the people who are talking, it is me and two expert colleagues. Go ahead and take a look at the video. And if you would rather just listen, this is your audio only option. Thank you so much. I hope you find it helpful. All right, we are now recording. So hello again, everybody. This is Dr. Leslie Kernison of Better Health While Aging. Welcome to this special free Q&A that we decided to offer about aging health in COVID times. And here is my son coming in. Just one moment. Ovi, so, je suis en meeting. So. Okay? Ferme la porte. All right, so fun COVID times means that we have children who come in even when you're doing your work. Okay, so moving on. So happy to be here to take your questions. And so what I'm going to do is we have on Better Health While Aging tried to focus a little bit. Yes, people are telling me they're in the same boat. Yes. On providing some additional information about coronavirus to support people. And then I reached out to ask what are people's questions and concerns. I've partly been wondering how much more of this should we do and how much should we return to our usual information. But we had lots of questions. And so I'm excited to have my two colleagues here with me to answer questions. And what we will do is we got something like 450 responses. We're not going to be able to answer all 450 today. Instead, what we're going to do is take questions from those of you who are here. We did go through them, so we've identified some recurring themes that we definitely want to touch on that are probably going to come on with your questions. But before I have Richard and Dr. Nicole introduce themselves, I just want to say that there is a Q&A box that you can see. Does everyone see where there's a Q&A box? If you are on mobile, sometimes you have to tap the screen for it to show up. If you have a question that you want us to answer today, can you please post it in the Q&A box? Not in the chat. If you are having like a technical difficulty question, you can post it in the chat. We have Natalie from our team who's answering questions. But otherwise, if you have a question about aging health or coronavirus or how to manage aging health issues in this really unusual time, go ahead and put it in the Q&A box so that we can get to it. And so now let me have my colleagues introduce themselves. And why don't we start with you, Dr. Nicole?
Thank you. So welcome, everybody. It's wonderful to see all this interest. My name is Dr. Nicole Didick, and I'm a geriatrician, just like Leslie Kernison, and I work in Canada. So some of your questions that are very related to the medical system in the United States, I might not be able to answer. But many things are very similar. So, and I have about 20 years of experience working with older adults, and I love to share information on the internet. I also have a website and a YouTube channel with lots of information, because I believe, as Dr. Kernison does, that it's a great way to learn more about our health.
Yes, and so some of you may have noticed Dr. Didick has actually become a regular contributor to Better Health While Aging and also to the Helping Older Parents membership, which is a program I started a year ago to provide ongoing guidance and support to people helping older parents. That's how we actually met. She joined us and then started volunteering her expertise. So we share this similar desire to bring what we know as geriatricians to the public online. And so she has been helping me both by answering questions in the Helping Older Parents membership, by answering comments on Better Health While Aging, which is a huge help to me. We've collaborated on some content, but she also has this fantastic YouTube channel. So as you may know, I don't usually do videos, but she's great at video. So if you are someone who likes watching, getting, you know, your information through video, I highly recommend her YouTube channel. We'll have a link to it in the notes that we're going to provide to you after this. And so now let me now turn it over. And actually, I'm going to stop the title slide just so you can all see us better. And I see that some people are putting in questions in the QA box. So that is fantastic. Please keep doing that. And then we're going to start addressing them. So Richard, please introduce yourself and be sure to tell everybody about the work you're doing with the Longevity Explorers.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name's Richard Caro. I'm the founder of something called Tech Enhanced Life, which has a website, but also enables is the word I prefer, a community of older adult longevity explorers who are people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, all around the world, but mostly in the US, who are interested in kind of the intersection of aging and technology and meet to explore that and try out new products and things. And so I guess my focus of being here today is anything that intersects technology and aging.
Right. Yes. And in particular, I have known Richard for several years. We're both based here in the Bay Area. And for a while, I was regularly updating my own technology blog. But one thing that I really love about the work that Richard has done as Tech Enhanced Life is you've really put older adults at the center of it, leading these groups of older adults talking about technologies and how they can address common problems. And so we've had Richard on the podcast at least three times, including to talk about the Longevity Explorers. But of course, now with everybody or most of us confined at home most of the time, you know, there's been even more interest in technology. So over the past several weeks, I've heard so many questions about helping older adults socialize or get activities from home. And so, you know, Richard is a great resource for me and for us in sharing with us both what he knows personally and also what's working for his groups that have already been technologically inclined. So Richard, thank you for being here with us today.
Looking forward to it.
Why don't we get right to some of the questions? And actually, maybe before I see like some of the questions that have been posted right here, but I want to start with one that I saw come up a lot in the survey answers, which is how to maintain physical and mental stimulation while being confined at home. And I think we saw kind of two versions of this come up. One was for people who, you know, respondents, Better Health While Aging readers who sounded like they are themselves in their 60s, 70s, 80s, but generally pretty healthy. But, you know, they're home a lot. They're not physically moving as much as possible, and it can be boring. So what to do to maintain that physical activity and mental stimulation. And then we had readers who wrote in and were worried about often a frailer older relative, like an older parent or someone else who maybe has some memory problems or dementia. And they were really kind of concerned about how to keep that person engaged and active. So I would love to hear from both of you kind of how you've been answering that question that we hear coming up over and over again. And maybe let's start with just kind of like for not people who have dementia, just for people who are now at home, older in their 60s, 70s, 80s, or even 90s. We might even have a 100-year-old. you know, what are ways that people can maintain physical activity and mental stimulation while staying at home and being safe?
You want to go, Nicole?
Well, I'll just tell you what, you know what, Richard, I'll say what I'm telling my patients right now that I'm connecting with virtually, and you can tell me whether you think that's right or not. But a lot of older adults who aren't living with dementia can actually be very tech savvy. So there are people, in fact, one of my colleagues is broadcasting his yoga classes on YouTube. And Facebook as well. So that's something that you can join exercise classes. There are a lot of really good live streams of trips down canal in a nice boat or something like, you know, you don't have to look too hard to find something like that. That's just a little bit different and a little bit sort of virtually stimulating. So that's kind of what I'm encouraging people to do. And I am hearing from older adults that some people are finding that that's really engaging. Other people are just using old-fashioned solutions of walking around their own properties, walking up and down their driveway, you know, use their exercise equipment that they've been using to hang clothes on, just kind of practical things like that. So it's pretty simple advice, but Richard, what would be taking it to the next level, do you think?
Well, I agree with all that. So let me just build on it maybe a bit. I mean, first of all, where I live in San Francisco, which is a sort of nice area with a big hill. When I go for my walk every day, it's full of people walking up the hill, right? All carefully on the other side of the pavement and stuff like that, socially distancing. So I'm not sure that anything stops you walking around and getting some exercise. That's one thing. And then, you know, in terms of consumption of stuff, there's lots of online classes and videos, the way you talked about, both for physical exercise, but also for, you know, virtually touring a museum and stuff like that. I think what I'd add to that maybe is at some point, you know, you get sick of just consuming and you want to actually talk to somebody. And that's where I think people are finding it more challenging. But our explorers who, you know, were all in their 70s and 80s and 90s, many of them have done things like taken their book club and turned it into a virtual book club, or their yoga class and turned it into a virtual yoga class. Some of them are in a ukulele group and now they get together on Zoom like we're doing now and all play the ukulele together. So I think we're seeing this platform we're using now, plus some other competing ones, as being quite powerful for letting you actually have a two-way interaction rather than just more fancy versions of television. So that's pretty interesting, I think.
Oops, I muted myself because I had a minor interruption again. So related to this, you know, when one is staying home is, you know, the sort of safest ways to address practicalities. And this is actually a question that somebody has put into the QA box, which is what would be the safest way to get our groceries? So let's talk about that for a little bit, because I know that's been a big theme, is people really want to be mindful of their exposure, right? So Richard, what are you seeing among your longevity explorers in terms of how they're managing getting groceries?
We've got an interesting thread going on Tech Enhanced Life at the moment where people are swapping information about this. You know, and the simple version, of course, is you can get stuff delivered using various online services. Some people are starting to run into troubles with getting slots and stuff. So it's becoming a bit of a full-time job to get your groceries delivered now at the moment. But a different angle is we've had quite a few people talking about the fact that they're friend or relative is so uninterested in technology that they aren't able to manage online ordering. And so a common scenario is their friend does the online ordering for them. And the discussion is all about, well, how do we get the money swapped over and how does that all work? And so, you know, because writing a check and handing it over to your friend who delivered the groceries is no longer a very convenient way of doing it. So now people are starting to get into online ways to swap money and things like that. So there's a few different dimensions, I think, depending on the tech savviness of the person in question.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so I guess things like PayPal or Venmo, right?
Yeah, all that, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is, in a way, an opportunity to kind of push everybody into learning a few additional tools,
totally.
Right? Which then they may or may not want to keep using. And so I guess later we'll find out if there was additional exploitation or errors associated with these tools, because that is sometimes a concern or an issue for certain older adults. Parlez-vous français, Dr. Kernison? I do, but we're not going to go into that right now. So also in terms of safe ways to get groceries, you know, one person whose answer I saw in the survey said that they were at least 90, I forget the exact age, and had been staying home, but was, you know, finding it kind of depressing to be home all the time, and asked, was it too dangerous to go out and get groceries? So I have thoughts on that, but, you know, maybe Dr. Nicole, let's start with you. What are you saying to people when they ask, is it really that dangerous for me to go out and get groceries? Because people understandably want a a change of scenery, right? Or a little activity.
You know, I think that's a really good point. And I have, my parents are in their 80s and they live in my town. And my dad has been going out to get groceries. So, and he also goes out to his church, but he's one of the only people who actually goes to the church. He is what's called the diak. He does all the singing at the church that he belongs to, which is basically the whole service is singing. And so he's there and the priest is there and it's live streamed to the other parishioners. So I'm just sort of sharing that because that's kind of an example of where we have to follow the rules, but we also have to make decisions that kind of involve some trade-off, right? And I think you've talked about this before, Dr. Kernison, where, you know, we have to look at sort of our goals and values and measure that against the risks. I think if you feel sick, you should stay home. If you're feeling well, I think it's reasonable to go out and do some grocery shopping, keeping 6 feet away from everyone. And most stores have, you know, little marks on the floor where you can't, you know, the aisles are one-way circuits. And just following those rules, don't touch your face. So when I go out, I wear a fabric mask usually just to remind me not to touch my face. But wash your hands, don't touch your face. Wash your hands before you eat anything that you bring in from the store and just kind of be sensible. So yeah, I would give permission to shop.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you bring up a good point and that, you know, people have asked, you know, the safest way to get your groceries, you know, yes, is to like not go out, right? Have them brought to you by someone who hopefully has used like the best hygiene possible, you know. There's been kind of, you know, question about like if they touch the bag or if they touch the products, you know, can you catch coronavirus from there? It does stay on surfaces, you know, especially hard impermeable surfaces. How dangerous that is for you is kind of like how much virus is on it and how long it's been, right? So if somebody coughed on it, and then you took it soon afterwards and took it and then touched your face, you would be at risk. But, you know, generally people who are doing deliveries, they're being asked, you know, to not work if they are sick. You know, some of them are wearing masks themselves, which prevent, you know, you transmitting what's in your throat out into the space around you. You know, so probably it's fairly low risk, but then, you know, could you go out? I mean, I think Dr. Nichols bring up a really important point. Dr. Didick.
Okay, Dr. Nicole.
I know, I'm used to calling her Dr. Nicole because the alliteration of Dr. Didick always like gave me a slight like stutter. But that the advice that we are going to get from our public health professionals is generally going to be extremely safety oriented, extremely safety oriented. And in a way that reminds me of regular medicine, where the focus is always on like safety and reducing your risk and mortality risk. And what comes up for us as geriatricians is that there is often a trade-off and a cost to that for older people, right? Who, if we're not careful, can have lots of things imposed on them medically because it's what's safest, but imposes a large burden on quality of life and daily life. And so I think this coronavirus situation makes me think of that too, that yes, it is safer to not go out at all, but right now the public health calculus is not taking fully into account your own mental health, right? And the other benefits to you personally of having some activity going out. And so when people have asked me, you know, I say, well, it's, you know, it's not going to be possible for it to be entirely safe or as safe as it was before this happened for quite a while, right? We don't, you know, like until the vaccine is available and widespread testing, you know, probably at least a year. So in the meantime, I encourage people to think, you know, to get better at thinking, what is unsafe about this situation? And how could I make it safer, right? And how, you know, how important is it? And so it would make going to the grocery store more unsafe, one, if there's a lot of coronavirus going on in your community, right? So it's important to pay attention to, like, in your community, is there a lot of it going on or just a little bit? So right now in San Francisco, we are presumed to have relatively low levels. We're not having a lot of people hospitalized because we did the shelter in place. So, You know, two, what are the precautions that the store is taking? Many stores right now are offering an hour for older adults or people who are high risk early in the morning, and they might allow fewer people in the store, and the store has just been cleaned, right? So can you go at the safer time? Can you go to a store that hopefully is less crowded, you know, if, you know, any stores are being a little bit more crowded? Our local grocery store here in San Francisco is just has just instituted a requirement where everybody who comes into the store is supposed to wear a face mask, you know, to reduce inadvertent transmission, right? So, you know, is the store doing that, or could you go to a store where that happens? Because again, the face mask is partly, the cloth face mask is meant to prevent people from accidentally sharing it with others. Because we know that some people have it and don't have symptoms, or they're in that window where they haven't yet developed the flu symptoms. Right? So going to a place where everybody in the store, their workers and the other shoppers are wearing masks is probably going to be a little bit safer. And then as Dr. Nicole is saying, you know, washing your hands a lot. I actually wear gloves when I go out. And the main reason is because I find I'm less likely to touch my face when I wear gloves. And because, you know, the strategy we have in our house is we put on certain things when we go out into spaces that are close to other people, and we take them off the moment we come in and wash like crazy. So it is part of like what we wear when we go into spaces when we might have exposure. So those are some of, you know, the ways one could do it. And, you know, is it as safe as staying at home? No, you know, but if it's true that we're looking at a situation where there's going to be some risk for probably for a few months, right? Or several months. So it's not just, can I stay home and never go out for 2 weeks? It's, you know, what is the impact on me of doing this for 3 months, 4 months? And I think for many people, it's reasonable to say, well, yes, by staying here, I reduce that risk, but this is what it's costing me. And that's a definite burden, right? That's a burden you feel every day. So I think it can be reasonable to make a considered decision to go out and then think about like, how can we do it as safely as possible. And then if you want to learn some new tech strategies, how to share money with other people online, you know, or get them delivered, through Instacart occasionally, you know, it's great to have options. Okay, so we've done that question. Let's now do related one, which is, Margaret asks, hello, I live with my 89-year-old mom. Can you give me some tips on helping the elderly get it, on why it's so important to stay home? Her question is, can't we just go to Safeway? So I guess, you know, before I ask you, Dr. Nicole, like how you're answering this, I was just wondering for you, Richard, you know, I see in the media sometimes people saying, well, a lot of older people just aren't taking this seriously. And I was kind of curious kind of what you're hearing from your community. And is it that people are really not taking it seriously, or is it just that they're making kind of a different value choice? Because it's occurred to me that sometimes they might just be making different choices. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, I don't have any definitive answers, but yeah, I do have some opinions that I've formed. I mean, I think there's a few different categories. There's quite a lot of people who are still a bit in denial of it all, but that's reduced a lot in the last couple of weeks. But say 2 weeks ago, there were lots of people who were just kind of thinking, oh, this will, I don't have to worry about this. But I think if you really look at why we're all locked, you know, sheltering in place, unless you look for a whole new world where people over 65 are never allowed out of their house ever again, or for 2 years or whatever it's going to be till we get a vaccine, it's really not about protecting the older adults. It's about protecting the healthcare system from temporarily being overburdened because we didn't prepare it adequately. Mm-hmm. And so I think the older adults, some of them who think about that, they make the decision that, you know, that why shouldn't they go out? Because after all, they've got to balance their sort of social aspects with their risk the way you do with lots of other things. It's kind of like driving or jumping out of airplanes or whatever hobbies you have. You know, there's always a risk-reward trade-off. So I think people are now looking forward and realizing that after the healthcare system has had time to get itself under control, then people will have to make their own decisions about their personal risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What about you, Dr. Nicole? What are you telling people?
Well, I am actually hearing that from a lot of the people that I'm talking to, that they're having trouble enforcing kind mm-hmm. of the rule with mm-hmm. the person. And usually that's a person who's living with dementia. Mm-hmm. You know, the older adults who aren't living with dementia, I would agree with Richard. There's people sort of making value judgments. But people who are living with dementia can often forget what exactly is going on. And so I think families are doing their best. I tell them to use distraction mm-hmm. as much as they can. Mm-hmm. So instead of, you know, go into the world of the person who's living with dementia and say, okay, to the person living with dementia, there isn't this pandemic. So if that were the way it was, but, you know, I would use distraction, or I would find a reason why we have to put it off, or I would do something else, you know. So distraction can be a really good way to go. Mm-hmm. And then I think too, I think if somebody is living with dementia, it kind of makes us all have to follow the rules a little bit more closely, right? Mm-hmm. Because there might be some people who, I know I have an aunt in another city who hasn't seemed to got that there is a pandemic, and she lives alone. And I know she's still going out and shopping as she always does. And I'm hopeful that other people around her will kind of, you know, give her some guidance and give her some space if she's not sort of able to navigate that herself.
Yeah. So, yeah.
There is some vulnerability there for sure.
Right. Right. And there it's sort of like, you know, if you were to somehow confine her or find a way to do it, you know, it sounds like it would be hard for it to be even feasible. It would impose a lot of distress on her. Right. You know, so when we look at our choices, do we confine her when she can't even understand it and she gets extremely distressed, you know, because there's a lot of burdens to that, you know, or she's going to go out. And again, that's, you know, we talk about this a lot in geriatrics, the benefits and burdens and the risks. And burdens are definite costs. You see them like right away, right? When we keep somebody from going out, especially if they can't understand it, they feel that distress right away. And risks are bad things that might happen, right? You know? Yeah. And so she is, you know, at risk going out, you know, especially since she probably can't remember to not touch her face and take all the precautions that we would, ideally. You know, it might be a risk that we've decided is reasonable. And I think it's also always important to remind everyone that even though coronavirus is a very serious condition and we should take this pandemic seriously, most people, even people who are much older, survive it, right? So the survival rate, even for people who are in their 80s, is, you know, approaches 80%. You know, probably in their 80s, over 80%. And in Italy, for one study, in people who are in their 90s, it was 78%. And I was reading recently the report from a nursing home that had an epidemic of it, and a lot of their residents got it, and they did have a lot of deaths. And also most of them did recover. So in modern healthcare, you know, something that gives people a 20% mortality rate, and maybe it's 20% among people who are in their 90s. It's probably lower actually, because we're only testing people who appear symptomatic, right? You know, that's horrifying for us as modern healthcare professionals. And at the same time, we want to remember that most people, even if they get it, even if they are older, even if, and all these older, most of these older people have some coexisting conditions, right? Most of them do survive it. So I want, you know, I think we should all be concerned and take precautions. And that sometimes I think the level of fear is maybe more than it needs to be. And then also, I guess, you know, for this question of helping an older person get it, I think of some of the general communication skills, right, that we teach families, which is, you know, first step back and try to find out more about, like, what do they know about it and how do they see it, right? So we were talking about older adults who weren't taking it seriously before. Was it just a kind of information gap? Maybe they were getting most of their information from certain media sources who shall not be named, who had a tendency to, you know, minimize it. Or was it that they, you know, did actually seem to have adequate information and just felt like, well, I heard that, like, you know, 80 to 85% of people like me are going to get over it. And I think that's a risk worth taking, right? You know, so we want to sort of understand more about how they saw it. And even for people who we think have dementia, it's useful to understand, like, where they are in their thinking so that we can then provide a response that fits in with their reality. So,
you know, can I add to that, Leslie?
Yeah, please do.
Because I think there's another aspect to this that's interesting. I think, so what I'm about to say is not about people with cognitive impairment. That's a whole different category, right? But for people who are mentally functioning well, I've noticed in our explorer groups that there's this, you know, society is already is always telling people what they should be doing in this age group, and telling them they need to do this and they need to do that, and they just don't get it and all that. But a lot of them feel like it's, you know, it's not somebody else's business to tell them how to think, and they might feel like they can make their own judgments about these sorts of questions. And who are the children of them or their friends to tell them otherwise if they're mentally functioning? So that's a different point of view, I think.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to, again, you know, that we want to start by, you know, helping people feel heard, right? And not assuming that they don't know and that they need to be told what to do. So moving on to more of these questions that have been posted. So someone anonymous asked, when and how might it be safe to go to routine dental and eye appointments? So yeah, Dr. Nicole, what are you telling people in response to that?
Well, I think we're going to have to wait for some direction there, because almost every almost everybody that I, you know, in my own dentist and that, they're on shutdown right now. So we're probably going to have to wait for some guidance. I know that it looks like Switzerland is opening up their things like that, like hairdressers as well, which we're all very anxious to see. April 27th. So, you know, in another 10 or 12 days, and that's in Switzerland. So, you know, I think it's going to be hard to make appointments. Now, you might be able to have a virtual appointment. So if it's something that you could do virtually over the phone, if it's just like a recheck of how, you know, how's it going, you could probably do that by phoning the person's office. But an in-person visit, I think it's probably going to be at least 3 weeks for non-emergency things.
I agree. I mean, and again, you know, this gets the question of, again, of like, when is it safe, right? So it is not going to be safe the way it was before, you know, for months, possibly a year. You know, so first of all, as you said, the providers have to be offering those appointments. And when they do that will probably be a function of local public health guidance. And encouragement. And then, you know, how risky it is going to depend on, you know, how much coronavirus is going on in your community and what are the precautions that the, you know, the provider and the clinic are taking to reduce risk of the workers transmitting anything to patients and also to prevent patients from transmitting anything to each other. The other thing that I think is going to come up, and I'm not sure exactly when, but there is this question of the antibody test, right? So there's been a lot in the United States about how we've had very limited testing for coronavirus. And initially the focus on the testing was a certain type of test to tell, to indicate whether the person had was sick from coronavirus right now. So basically whether they were shedding virus, right? Which means that, you know, one, they are sick or could get quite sick, and two, that they are contagious and transmitting it to other people. But the other test that is just starting to come out now is the antibody test. So this is a test of your blood to see if you have antibodies to coronavirus, because if you do, then it means you had it and you have recovered. Now, we don't know how long people will stay immune. The thought is probably most people, at least some immunity for 6 months, you know, maybe 12, maybe longer. They don't think it's going to be lifelong, like for some conditions. But in that case, you know, there is the question in some countries of, do we let people go back to work or work in certain higher risk or certain higher stakes occupations once they have an antibody test showing that they had it, which means they'll be less, you know, very unlikely to get it again and be transmitting it. Right. So I think that might change things, the calculus a lot, you know, in terms of when we can go to certain spaces is, you know, will we be able to find out, will the healthcare facility be able to test its workers and see who has already had coronavirus? And so then is not going to be, you know, is going to be extremely unlikely to transmit it to, you know, patients who we generally consider a vulnerable population. So that would be another thing that, you know, that I'm looking forward to. Honestly, you know, having that more,
that'll be very valuable.
Right. And then the other thing is, will older adults be able to get tested? And if they have antibodies, feel like they can go out and not be worried or tell their family, look, you don't need to worry about me.
You know, there's also the rise of telehealth, right? That maybe is a good time to talk about that if you want. That's an interesting dimension.
Yes. Yeah. Well, what have you, what has been the experience of your longevity explorers with telehealth?
Well, it's very nascent because, you know, it was almost non-existent until recently, but suddenly lots of insurance companies are paying for it. And a number of primary care practices are sort of converting to try and do lots of things remotely. It doesn't help when you need a filling, of course. You know, they're every day they try and do more and more things remotely. And so I think the fact that that exists is kind of an interesting thing to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've been doing telehealth visits, I must say, since for almost a month now. We've moved our clinic, was in a hospital, and it was actually converted into the community COVID testing site. So we find a different way of doing things. And luckily in Ontario, there's an Ontario telemedicine network platform, which looks kind of like a Zoom. And so I've been doing phone visits and Zoom visits exclusively for the last month. And it's actually great. I think families really like it because it's, you know, they can stay in their own home the other people can connect, like at a visit with the two family members who were in the home, the patient and her partner. And then one family member was in the Yukon and one was in British Columbia. So, you know, we were all able to be on the same call. So people really like it. And I can do a lot of things. I actually did a, Dr. Kernison will understand, I did a MOCA for the blind over telehealth.
Oh, yes, so, yes. I heard that it's not available for remote administration.
Yeah. So yeah. I think it's great. And Richard, I'm glad to hear that that the explorers are interested in that too, because I love it. And I'm hoping, and our province has kind of, we have one insurer, which is the province. So they've allowed us to bill for the virtual appointments. And I'm hoping they'll allow us to keep doing that, because I think there's definitely a role for it to continue. I think the people like it, and I like it because I can sit here and do it.
Yeah.
Well, can I just say one more thing? So there's another interesting development, because I mean, you're a bit limited with what you can diagnose by telehealth, right, normally. But one of the primary care practices in San Francisco is recommending to its patients that they acquire a few goodies, like a pulse oximeter and a blood pressure cuff and, you know, a thermometer. And if you think about it, once you have those devices in the remote place, you suddenly expand the number of things you can diagnose quite a lot.
Yeah. If you have, see a bunch of people at a nursing facility or something, you know, like an assisted living home or something, if there's one nurse who has that equipment.
Absolutely.
And especially the nurse you've worked with before, they can listen to the chest and, you know, it is amazing what you can appreciate over video.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have a digital stethoscope now, so you can auscultate the patient remotely.
Yes, well, the patient has to have it. There was them, but they do. I guess in the nursing home, maybe. But yes, so Medicare has, so I think this is going to be another instance where the situation is pushing forward technological, you know, people to adapt when they otherwise wouldn't have. And Medicare in the United States is now, you know, paying for telehealth visits, I think at the same rate as they were paying inpatient or in person, I should say. Visits. And I think, you know, the challenge is just that the providers still have to be equipped to do it, right? They have to find the platform and set up their billing. And that generally, I would say healthcare providers tend to take the path of least resistance. And to change that, there needs to be a pretty substantial financial incentive. But this, you know, might be the thing that does it. So I think it is going to end up being something really good for a lot of patients, you know, to not have to spend all these hours at the waiting room, or for our older patients who sometimes are frailer or disabled, you know, the transportation can be really challenging. We have families who spend a lot of time shuttling a loved one to the visits, and that might be made simpler. And I think that's going to be really a great thing. So let me keep
Sorry, one more thought and then I'll let you go on. So it makes you also realize that if you're the patient, if you're the older adult, asking whether your primary care physician can do all those things or not is kind of an important detail to find out. And in my mind is sort of one of the factors that goes into deciding which primary care practice you might want.
Yes, yes. And certainly hearing from their patients, you know, their patients asking for this, I think is going to make, you know, help provide that encouragement for practices to manage that transition. So I think that's completely true. Okay, so Jack asked, this one's fairly medical. My mom is having tremendous hospital-induced delirium, much more than before. Is this due to the quarantine, no visitors required by the pandemic? It's very scary. She's decompensated markedly over 3 weeks. Normally, she has Parkinson's with mild cognitive impairment. Okay, so Jack, I don't know if you are still here. Since it's been 3 weeks, my guess is that she's not still in the hospital. Because to be in the hospital for 3 weeks right now is pretty tricky. If you are here, she's in a rehabilitation hospital. I see. So, so she's in a skilled nursing facility for short-term, rehab. And she was 2 weeks in a regular hospital. And how old is she? Well, I don't know that it matters a ton. We'll see if Jack tells us how old she is or not. So we do have an article on Better Health While Aging about delirium. So she's 78, an acute facility with an attending. Yeah, so delirium is that state of worse than usual mental function that comes on often in the hospital when older adults are sick or under a lot of physical stress. And if you have a brain that's already been damaged by illnesses or disease, so like Parkinson's, then you are, you know, it's easier to be tipped into delirium. And so even before coronavirus and the quarantines, a lot of older adults would develop delirium while in the hospital, and it often takes weeks for people to recover. And the recovery is partly about removing the trigger, the illness, and then any other kinds of triggering conditions. We have a list of them in the article that might have made it worse, and then supportive care. So I think the challenge with the pandemic is that for many older adults, family is very reassuring and helps create the restorative environment for them to recover from delirium. And right now, family are not allowed. I think this must be a very difficult time for older adults who have delirium and are trying to recover. Do you have anything you'd add, Dr. Nicole?
Yeah, it's awful. And I think that's what's keeping a lot of people from even going to hospital right now, is that worry about not being able to have visitors. Mm-hmm. It makes so much more difficult of an experience.
Yeah.
And it's a roller coaster ride. I mean, that's the other thing, Jack, is that delirium tends to fluctuate. There are times when you think, oh, they're better now, they've had like one good day, and then the next day it's back to being confused and drowsy. And so it can very much be a roller coaster ride. I think, you know, checking in with the team as much as you can to ask about which medications she's on, encourage them or check in to make sure that she's on her Parkinson's medications, that she's not getting other medication, you know, if she's not getting pain medicines that she doesn't need, sleeping pills she doesn't need, even ask them if her bowels are working. You know, those basic things can be so important to just getting back into a routine. So
yeah.
It might be a long road, but
often overlooked. Constipation. Yeah. Very easy for it to happen to older adults and often overlooked. And I think, you know, one of the questions that people, you know, were asking on Better Health While Aging before coronavirus, when they had a loved one with delirium in the rehabilitation, is, you know, should I bring them home? Right. Because for some people, going home is a calmer, more restorative environment that does, you know, facilitate the recovery. The trouble is that initially, certainly the first few days and sometimes for a while, they can need a lot of assistance. And that can be very hard for family. Now, before people were leaving the home to work, Now people are often doing that less, although you may still need to work at home, right? It depends a bit on your situation. Yes, usually for persistent delirium, we kind of look at, you know, is there an infection or a trigger? Are there medications? You know, have we checked on all the contributors, the dehydration, the constipation, the uncontrolled pain? And if we have, then it's, you know, supportive care. What could help, you know, them be in a more restorative environment? And for somebody who has Parkinson's, I mean, that does injure the brain. It could be a long, slow recovery. So, yeah.
And sometimes we get, sometimes there's a percent change. You know, sometimes there are actually persistent changes, it seems like, in the deep white matter of the brain after a delirium. So it can, 8% of people 6 months after a delirium are back to where they were before, but many are not. So mm-hmm. It may be that the baseline is new. It might be a different baseline that before, unfortunately.
But we do want to give her chance at recovery. And some people, you know, but especially if they're frailer, it can be weeks or months for slow improvements. And then often settling at still a lower baseline, sometimes getting back to where they were before. Okay. And I forgot to mention earlier that although we scheduled for an hour, we all decided that we were able to stay up to an extra half hour to answer questions. So we will keep going through your questions. So Linda asked, am I considered high risk having had breast cancer in 2000 and 2017 with chemo radiation, bilateral mastectomy? I'm 72 and lead a very healthy lifestyle. All right, I'll let you take this one, Dr. Nicole.
Well, are you at increased risk for getting coronavirus or for getting sick with coronavirus? So, you know, I mean, I'm happy to hear that, you know, your surgery was a couple of years ago. So that's, I think, the further away people are when it comes to cancer from their diagnosis and treatment time, then that's a good thing. And so if you're what they call sort of immunocompromised, so if you have kind of that low grade inflammatory process, which could be from if you had an active cancer or if you were undergoing cancer treatment, some of the effects of that could make your immune function as optimized as it should be. So that would put you, Linda, at increased risk of getting sick, you know, from a virus or something. You might be more susceptible because you wouldn't be able to, your body's mechanism for fighting that off wouldn't be as developed as other people. But you know, if you're, like you mentioned, you're living a healthy lifestyle. So if you're exercising, eating well and sleeping and managing your stress and avoiding toxic habits like smoking, for example, then you're probably doing everything you can to keep your to keep your immune system working well, and your risk would probably not be that much different than another 72-year-old, you know, unless you're sort of actively going through chemotherapy or you have another medical condition. So I would say it's probably pretty close to what it would be for the average 72-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I agree. I mean, I'd say, well, you know, yes, you could be considered higher risk, but I think also it's sort of like, you know, first of all, nobody knows exactly what the risk is for people who are 72, in that we still never know exactly how many people in their 70s got the virus, right? Because we haven't been able to count everybody for the most part in an area and see what happened to them. But, you know, even if it was, well, you have, you know, a 20% chance of becoming significantly ill, you know, or a 10% chance, let's say, for a 72-year-old of becoming significantly ill. And because you had the breast cancer, maybe it's now a you know, it's gone from 10% to 15%, right? Or even if it went from 10% to 20% chance of getting significantly ill, my question to you would be, how will that change what you're doing, right? So if... you know, would you change that decision of whether to go to the grocery store if it was 10% versus 20%, right? Maybe you would and maybe you wouldn't, right? Maybe what would change it is if it was between 1% and 10%, you know? Or would you change if it was 20% or 50%? I don't, you know, I think we don't really have particular reason to believe that you're at like 50%. But, you know, sometimes I think people get, you know, very caught up in the details of trying to get their exact risk. And I would sort of ask, like, what difference would it need to make for you to change something that you were going to do? You know, what difference? And so some of the things that, you know, people have been asking us about is going to the grocery store. We also had several people ask about, you know, hugging their grandchildren, right? You know, we have Mother's Day coming up in a month. And we had a reader ask, you know, I was supposed to get together with my family, and will I be able to hug my grandchildren, right? So if we told you your regular risk for the, you know, 72-year-old versus high risk, you know, would it change your decision to hug your grandchildren? Now, maybe we'll talk about that decision right now. You know, is it safe to hug your grandchildren? You know, again, what I would say is, first of all, how much coronavirus is going on in your community and their community, right? You know, one. But two, what have they been doing to protect themselves, right? How much exposure have those children been having? So my own children, since we've been doing shelter in place in San Francisco, have not gone into an indoor space with other people and have not touched other people. So we go out to the park, and maybe we can talk about, is the park safe? We go out to the park and we walk and we bike and we throw a Frisbee with each other. So I actually think that my, you know, because that's what we've been doing with, you know, our children, they are at pretty low risk of carrying it. And so if we had an older relative whose, you know, greatest desire was to be in the same room with them for a holiday, you know, I would sort of consider that. If, you know, whereas if I'm not required to work outside my home, but, you know, some cities have programs where if both parents are essential workers or healthcare workers, there's childcare for their children, right? So that's great for those children, and those children who are spending the day with eight other children are going to be at higher risk for carrying something, right? So, you know, those would be, again, some of the, you know, things that I would be thinking about as I, you know, consider those questions of risk and of what are, like, you know, what are the safety considerations and the risk considerations in attempting a certain activity that you may want. And again, if you have that gathering with the grandchildren, there's a definite benefit, right? You know you're going to have that benefit. You just don't know how much risk you're being put at. And would knowing that you were at a little higher risk than somebody your age or not change it for you? And I can't really answer that, but those would be some of the ways that I would be thinking about it. Now, Richard, I have a question for you, which is that one of the participants here asked, you know, for older adults who didn't already have like a social media circle and are now feeling socially isolated, are there, you know, what are ways to go and connect with other people online that you might suggest or that are safe or that are viable? Any thoughts on that?
Only imperfect ones. You know, there's a lot of people interested in that topic now. There are some little companies thinking about how to meet that need, but they haven't really done it successfully yet. But I think there are existing groups online. I don't have a good one to mention. I think some Googling, you might find some, you know, like existing book clubs, music groups, things like that, that welcome new members. That would be where I would look. I think there's a big need for that sort of thing, actually. And I think there's been that need for a long time, but now it's just really coming to the top of people's mind.
Right. And I actually haven't looked, but just in thinking about it right now, I thought of Meetup, right?
I thought the same thing.
And I was just wondering, you know, like, you know, are people creating new meetups that are online? And is that a place where potentially an older person could look for a group that has, you know, so meetup.com, for people who don't know, you know, was a platform created to facilitate local meetings around a certain interest or demographic. The person who creates the meetup gets to sort of say who it's for and what are the activities. And they can even say whether it's open to everyone or only open to certain people, you know, like on request. So when I looked a while back in San Francisco, I mean, there are meetups for people who like to walk in certain areas. There are meetups for people who are a certain age range, you know, and have some other life characteristic to socialize. There are meetups around book clubs. So yeah, we should look, but I would think that a lot of that has gone virtual. And so it might be possible for older adults to look and find a meetup that, you know, has a participant group or an interest focus that is a fit for them, right?
I know there are some that have gone virtual, but I'm not sure if it's many or not, but I'm guessing more and more will. Mm-hmm. I see a comment in the chat area that talks about that.
Oh yeah. The Feldenkrais class uses Meetup and was in person and now it's on Zoom. So I would say yes. So that would be another possibility. Okay. So continuing on with the questions people have submitted. We've received notification that Wisconsin will continue to be quarantined through the month. This is a question from Dane. Through the month of May, preventing loved ones from visiting their elder family members in assisted living and long-term care facilities. As an RN care coordinator, I'm witnessing an increased level of anxiety and depression in my elderly patients as well as their family members. Are there direct resources or recommendations that can be offered to these patients and family members? All right, well, Dr. Nicole, any suggestions?
Yeah, that's hard. And, you know, I know there are a lot of online counseling sort of platforms are offering free counseling right now, I've noticed. So some of the counseling agencies in our region have sort of advertised on Facebook and that there's counseling for people who are feeling distressed for whatever reason, but some of it could be brought on by this isolation and worry. And I'm encouraging people to use virtual visits as much as they can. So, you know, I'd be interested to hear what Richard mostly recommends to people, but a lot of people can use things like FaceTime or their phone, you know, or even like their phone to do a video call or even just their regular phone to stay connected. So those are my main suggestions. I have had people do window visits where they're on one side of the window and the older adult is on the other side. Which is effective for keeping out droplets. So, you know, those would be sort of my practical suggestions. It's very difficult. What do you think, Richard? Like, what are you telling people would be the way to go there?
For social interactions you're talking about now?
Well, to connect with your relative who's in a retirement home and you haven't visited for a month, right? And you may not be able to for a few more weeks.
You know, it's sort of complicated. It depends how technically savvy they are or whether there's someone to help them set things up. So if they already are in the Apple world and they have Apple products and everything, and you do too, then FaceTime is very good and easy to use. If they've got a computer or a tablet and they aren't in the Apple world, or if you want to have group interactions, we recommend Zoom at the moment, which is the platform we're using right now. But then there's a whole class of people who, for various reasons, aren't going to be comfortable with either of those because they're too complicated to learn and there's no one to help them. And there's another interesting technology, a product called made by Amazon called the Echo Show. It's a screen that you talk to. And if you set it up correctly, you can make a call just by saying, call Fred or Joan or, you know, whoever. And that's super easy to use and even works, I think, for people who have cognitive impairment at various levels. But it's not so trivial to set up. So the people we've been interacting with who sort of have an older adult somewhere locked in and they haven't done anything about it before and now they want to give them something, they're wrestling a bit with the question of how would I get it set up for them.
Yeah, right.
How people will put some of these things in place afterward, you know, after this settles for the next time, because there could be another time.
Absolutely.
No, and a lot of homes don't have, even outside of Corona, there's often flu outbreaks or gastro outbreaks, so there will be other times. So yeah, hopefully those are really good tips to maybe for Christmas, right? If you don't know what to get the older adult who has everything,
mm-hmm. get them an Echo Show. you know, there's another interesting angle on that because we've been playing around with these sort of tools for several years now. And there were always some of our explorers who loved them, but there were also some who felt like, it's just too much trouble to learn. You know, I could learn, but why bother? I'll just go see somebody. And what I've noticed in the last month is suddenly many of those people who before couldn't be bothered learning suddenly are now super motivated and aren't actually having much trouble with it either. So there's a huge motivation shift, which I think is probably quite important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess one of the things that I might think about is a product that somebody in the Helping Older Parents membership tried for her father, who is, I think, 92 and had some dementia, but it's the Jerry Joy tablets, which is offered by Care.coach. And so you get a tablet and it has a little dog avatar. But they actually have people in developing countries who manage the conversation and will converse with the older person, and they are trained to converse and interact with people who have cognitive impairments. And a lot of older people have found that helpful. The little avatar can show pictures of the home too. That is a more, expensive option in that I think it's at least $200 some a month right now. They're actually offering a discount for people from Better Health While Aging. So, that's another possibility. I mean, this has, historically been used for some older people who live alone as a less expensive alternative to having a paid companion come to provide that companionship, because it's much less expensive than that. But I know that right now, finances are difficult for a lot of people. But I think this speaks again to the fact that right now the focus in terms of managing coronavirus is very much on minimizing mortality. And we're not yet sort of taking into account the other, the definite burdens that that's bringing on, right, that we Absolutely. Are seeing, and then the additional risk, because there is, of course, an additional health risk that comes with, sustained isolation, right? And so some readers did ask, that say that they're very worried because they have a parent in memory care or otherwise in residential living with cognitive impairment, and they're either worried that the isolation is going to accelerate that dementia decline, or they see it already happening, right? Because we know that people who have dementia do need regular activity, regular social encounters to thrive. And so they're very worried about that and asking, what can they do? And so I think this is a tough situation. And so as Richard and Dr. Nicole were saying, if it's possible for you to get a device in there and have, the FaceTime or the interaction, that's something, if something like Jerry Joy is an option, you could, you could try that. But that's what we have right now. Some families have taken their loved one out. That's a possibility. I think the caution there is that you're not, it's not taking them out for a week, right? it would be probably for like weeks or months until the situation is normalized. And so, you as the family have to ask yourselves, like, are you equipped to have that person in your home and to provide that, that all the time care for that? Because that's, that's a significant responsibility, and you have to take care of your health too. And then, I don't know if with the antibody testing or beta testing, if, when they talk about opening things up, I wonder, will they be able to sort of resume more activities in those facilities, right? And it will make a difference if family, if the message that facilities keep getting from people is what's most important is that you minimize their risk of catching this virus and dying, then they're going to be extremely conservative like this. And if the message that they start getting is, their socialization activity is very, very important, what are ways that we can bring some of that back? These are conversations that I feel as geriatricians that we usually have with individual families. I'm not sure how it's going to work with a community, but part of me kind of wonders, like, is that where we will eventually be in a month or two? Because I do think the longer this goes on, the more apparent it's going to become the toll that it is going to take on a lot of older adults. So yes, Sophia says it's a goals of care discussion about pros and cons. Would you accept the risk of infection and complications versus quality of life? So that's true. And again, that's, a conversation we have individually with families. And I wonder, will they be able to have it with groups, right? Or could you perhaps, at a facility, could they take a group that has decided to accept a little bit more risk, right, for socializing, and have other people stay isolated? I wonder about that. But again, as long as everybody's number one focus is prevent mortality, that's going to be difficult. And if we open it up and say, there are these trade-offs, let's talk about the trade-offs and what might be an acceptable trade-off, maybe we can end up with something that brings back a little bit more quality of life to people. So
Can I just add one thing? You know, I've been just in the last week, I've been doing an interesting project that involved exploring people's points of view about why they make decisions to move into a senior living facility rather than stay at home. Mm-hmm. And we've interviewed a number of people about it, and some of them who've already moved and some of them who are thinking about it. And what's interesting is several of them have commented that their whole point of view about whether or not they even want to live in a senior living facility has been impacted by this pandemic. Because if you think about it, the whole trade-off of the benefits and costs is no longer the same. Mm-hmm. And so it will be interesting to see if that persists when the dust settles.
Right, right. Yes, very much so. So we have someone who Kay wrote, my mother is locked down in her memory care home. She doesn't do well on phones, just voices. She doesn't do well on phones that have just voices and not a person to see. And she has macular degeneration, so seeing is relative. I call weekly, but it's frustrating for both of us. I haven't seen her in a month. I write to her, but how do I keep her from forgetting me? Oh, any thoughts, either of you?
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, does she forget you already? Like, does she have some cognitive impairment? Like, is it the kind of thing that changes?
I think so. She's in a memory care home, so.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think you just, that is really difficult. And it's hard with that sensory impairment, right? So with the hearing and the visual changes, that's hard. Because otherwise I would say you could send her photos. You could send her video clips and things like that and have somebody kind of play that for her. Oh, she has vascular dementia, it says. Yeah, so mm-hmm. things might be a little patchy there, but maybe just sending her things that will remind her of you physically, you know, send those to her. That might be a good way to keep that connection. Mm-hmm. And just enjoy those moments when you do have a connection, and hopefully that it'll come back when, because you're in her long-term memory, right? So it's vascular dementia, so it's not necessarily like Alzheimer's where the long-term memory persists, but if it's a mixed kind of picture, then you know you're in that long-term memory probably, so she'll still have you in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kay says she's forgotten my dad who died 18 months ago. I think, you know, again, I think those are good thoughts. You know, one of the things that occurred to me, I don't know if it would work or not, but, you know, could you record something and could they play it for her? You know, maybe at higher volume, and sometimes the quality that you can record can be better than a phone transmission. You know, even sort of like, you know, telling her a little something about your day and I love you. It could even be played repeatedly, right? She might not remember it. And then the other thing is, I would say, is her not forgetting you about her or about you, you know? So, because I understand we want people we love and care about to know us. Right now, I think sometimes stepping back and thinking, you know, there's going to be your distress and sadness that you're not connecting with her, and that maybe that's facilitating the process of her forgetting you. And like, what can help her right now feel the best she can in this time, you know? Because we had, some people tell us that the problem is that when they do get in touch with, you know, their older parent with dementia, that then the parent's distressed because why aren't you here, right? Why am I not home? You know, and that sometimes not having those reminders, even though that's sad for family members who still want to be part of their lives, that allows the person with dementia to sort of focus. I mean, that's, you know, especially under more normal circumstances where often there are activities for them, right? Right now there may not be the activities. But, you know, I would bring that up too. It's a very like sad, difficult time right now for families, because to a certain extent, you know, we have to try to do what we can. And often accept that things are so different than we wish they were. and that there are all these things that we're not able to do that we wish we could do for these people that that we love so much. So yeah, Kay says it's about me 100%. I know. Well, mm-hmm. So yes. Okay. So this is one of our, you know, core themes in the Helping Older Parents membership is, you know, reminding people to sort of separate out what they need from what their parent needs. And sometimes there are other ways to meet our needs. You know, ways to support you with that sorrow and grief of being separated from her and of feeling like she is going to forget you. That would be some of what I would, you know, suggest thinking about. So Tom asks, I've read that a critical time seems to be about 1 week into the virus when both respiratory effects and immune system seems to step up. I would appreciate your comments about appropriate treatments at this stage, particularly for people with a history of inflammation. Okay. Yeah. All right. You first, Dr. Nicole.
Hydroxychloroquine. No. You know what? I don't think we know. I mean, I think we're still learning a lot. So even though we've had several months of experience on a global scale with the virus, I still don't think it's clear that that medication, that any one particular medication works. You know, there have been lots of use of things like steroids and antibiotics and antivirals and biologic infusions and things like that. And so I don't think we can recommend any particular medication right now. You know, and I think a lot of it is supporting it's supportive care. I've heard some interesting things about a technique that's called proning, which is if someone is sick enough to be in the ICU, that they, if they're upside down, so lying prone, like with your face down, that seems to somehow be helpful, and maybe it provides, you know, the air circulation to a different zone of the lungs or something like that. So there's a lot of techniques. Yeah. So the proning has been around a long time. So there's a lot of techniques that, you know, are being tried, but I don't think there's a clear protocol for what to do other than what we always do when someone is very ill, is that supportive treatment and supporting the other organ systems that might be affected, like the kidneys and the heart, while we wait for the lungs to get better.
Yeah. No, I would agree. And it's true that, yes, you know, it seems that for most people who are symptomatic from COVID, that they, you know, might get a fever, they might have symptoms, they might get some respiratory symptoms for a few days. And then that there does seem to be this moment about a week in where many people start getting better and some people start getting worse and sometimes quite dangerously worse. So at that point, if they are getting a lot worse, you know, the recommendation right now is if you're high risk, so if you're an older adult or have chronic conditions, or if your oxygen levels are going down, then you should, you know, definitely be thinking about going to the hospital, assuming that's something you've decided you want to do, because we haven't talked about it yet, but certainly, especially for people who are much older or frailer or have dementia, you know, there's the advanced planning question of if you were sick enough to go to the hospital, would you want to go there where you are going to be, you know, definitely separated from other people, and people who are frailer have less of a chance of, you know, surviving in general. But if, you know, for your goals of care or health state, you would want to be hospitalized, that would be a time to go. And there, and so what I want to share actually with people is a resource that I think not everyone knows about, but, you know, in clinical medicine for a long time, as clinicians, we've relied on something called UpToDate.com. This is a technical resource for, you know, providers, but it is right here. And so they have a whole series on COVID, and they are making their COVID clinical topics available for free to the public during this time. So if you want to read kind of the technical nitty-gritty summarizing the latest, you know, suggestions on what to do, this is an option to consider. So that's just a little something that I thought that I would mention. Now, what did I do with my questions box? Just one moment.
Richard, well, Dr. Kernison's looking for a question. I want to ask you what you think about robots. So it's probably hard to get your robot in there now, but I'm just thinking about, because I've seen some excellent studies, some very simple robots to encourage people to do things like wash their hands or to, you know, encourage people to eat. Or so what's your feeling about robots, and could that be something we could get operationalized now for the next time this happens? I don't want to take jobs away from any personal support workers, but.
No. I'm a big fan of robots. I think their time is coming. I'm not sure it's quite come. But it all depends what you mean by a robot. You know, some people think of it as a thing that looks like a human and does all sorts of stuff. I think they're not really there yet. But something as simple as the, I mentioned a product called the Amazon Echo Show before, which has inside it an artificial intelligence that if I speak its name, it will trigger the one that's sitting on my desk. But it begins with an A, A-L-E-X-A. And that's an example of a robot in my mind. And so I think if you're willing to define robots as, you know, very simple artificial intelligences, I think they're already quite useful. And the reason I was positively mentioning that product before in the context of social interactions is the artificial intelligence does all of the work of listening to you. And when you say, call Mr. Smith or call my daughter or call, you know, Mabel, it figures out what that is and figures out how to place the call. And so it's really removing the busy work from the interaction. And so for some people, you might argue that's not necessary and who needs that. But if you're having trouble with the busy work, I think it's got a real role. And I think maybe with luck, we'll see more and more of those sort of things going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's that'll be, so it might be a silver lining with all this, you know, is again, like pushing forward both the technology, but as you said, also the motivation, right, for people to engage.
I think the motivation is an important one.
And start building up their skills to interact with it.
Well, just take an example of all these people who are thinking now about, wouldn't it be nice if their parent had such a thing in their room so they could communicate with them, right? I mean, that's not, they could have thought that 3 years ago, right? And some people did, but most people didn't. And now they're triggered to think about it. So it's not just motivation on the part of the older adult, it's the whole ecosystem, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So next question, this is a little bit related to the prior medical question, which is, could we please talk about palliative care at home for those whose directives of many years refuse ventilation? So yes. So as we were saying, there are some older adults who have already reached a stage in their life where they've completed a directive saying that if they are very sick, they would not want mechanical ventilation. Often those are people who also have said they don't want CPR or resuscitation. Yes, have you been getting questions like this from your patients, Dr. Nicole, and what are your recommendations on this?
Absolutely. And I think that is, today is Advanced Care Planning Day, actually, in my province of Ontario.
Oh, you're right. It's National Healthcare Decisions Day this week.
Okay, there you go. So, you know, one thing too that's a bit of a silver lining is that I'm hoping that more people will think about advanced care planning. And you know, I kind of thought of that too when we were talking about the culture in a lot of retirement homes is to you know, promote life at all costs and all this prevention and, you know, the medical sort of burdensome things that we put on people. I think when we do advanced care planning correctly, we can get more at what people's goals and values are and support those. In a way that we don't just have to think about them in a crisis. So, you know, I'm really hopeful that that people will do more advanced care planning. And we can share, there are a lot of tools that people can use. And actually, another resource that is providing some free resources right now is Pallium, P-A-L-L-I-U-M, I think. So that's a Canadian palliative care education resource for healthcare professionals, but it has some good modules about decision-making and goals of care discussions and that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's very, very relevant to right now. And so a lot of people are bringing up their goals because they want to avoid being in hospital without any visitors, or they want to avoid a ventilator. Or I've even heard some of my colleagues say they want to avoid being put in the ICU because they don't want to put their other colleagues at risk if they mm-hmm. were that ill. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is really bringing a lot of that care. And I wanted to ask Richard too, like, when it comes to these kinds of things, like, do you, because there are tools that we sometimes use, like e-prognosis is one where you can, you know, look at, kind of helps you weigh the pros and cons using a little electronic decision aid. Like, do you find that the older adults that you've worked with kind of would use something like that to help with decision making, like an app to kind of, you know, should I move into a retirement home and go through the checklist? And
you know, there's such a huge spectrum of people, it's very hard to generalize. That's one of my biggest lessons from all our work. So some of them are super techie and love things like that, and some of them would hate it. I think the real question that we should ask ourselves, though, is whether those products actually do a good job or not. Often they're very simplistic, and, you know, a paper checklist, all they really are is a paper checklist turned into an app. So I think the potential is huge, and I think people would use them if they really believe they did something useful for them, but often they don't.
Right. Well, I think to come back to the question, I think, you know, one thing that people have asked is, you know, how do we talk about this goals of care conversation in the time of coronavirus? And there are resources online. One of my favorite advanced care planning resources is prepareforyourcare.org. And they now have a whole section about, you know, planning for this question of, would you want to go to the hospital, you know, if a ventilator was available, assuming one is available, would you want to be on it? Given that depending on the person's age and health situation, I mean, we don't have exact data yet, but so far what we're finding is that people who are older adults who are sick enough to require the ventilator are not doing well for coronavirus. So the mortality rate for people sick enough to be on the ventilator. So again, most people who get it do not get gravely ill and survive. But when people are sick enough to have to go on the ventilator, there's a quite high mortality rate, and the survivors are disproportionately younger people. So so I think, you know, Linda's question is also about, like, how do we, you know, so if somebody says, oh, well, you know, already I didn't want to be on a ventilator, and with this situation, I definitely don't want to be on a ventilator, how could we care for them at home if they do end up being quite sick? And so what I would say is, you know, a couple options. So one is to find out what's available. First of all, if you know that you're, that this older person feels that way, I would bring it up to the health provider right away and ask them, you know, how can they help you? Like, you know, again, anticipating, you know, if you or your older parent were to get quite sick, right? So, you know, to become one of those people where after 7 days, you're actually getting very short of breath. If you have one of those low oxygen monitors, it's getting low, you know, but you don't want to go to the hospital because you feel like you'd prefer to die at home, right? You know, how would they be able to help support you? So I would, you know, find out like what the primary care provider is able to do. And the other question is what's available in terms of hospice in your area? And what are they currently able to do for people who are suspected to have coronavirus? There is a Center for Advancing Palliative Care, and I will post a link. We've posted a link before on Better Health While Aging. They have a section on managing symptoms for coronavirus. You know, the standbys are what hospice uses for shortness of breath in general, which is opiates, so liquid morphine, or actually a fentanyl patch that provides kind of continuous help with that breathless feeling and with any pain. And then often, you know, sedatives for any anxiety or agitation. Rolling over on your side or on your belly might help with the breathlessness. So, you know, I think the ideal for people who have decided they don't want ventilation and get quite sick for coronavirus, you know, ideally would be home hospice. And then it would be sort of, what are the backups? So is your usual provider going to be able to, you know, help you get those medications and provide some guidance on using them? you know, or what would be your options? If it's any comfort, I learned a lot from a Jerry Powell episode. So jerrypowell.org is a geriatrics palliative care podcast that was created by my colleagues here at UCSF. And they interviewed somebody who works at a skilled nursing facility on the East Coast where they had an outbreak. And so he described the kind of course they saw in many of their residents. So Jerry Powell, and I'll post a link to the specific episode. And so he said that most people had, you know, some fever, blahs, got better after 5 or 7 days. Some got worse and some got quite sick. But when they got quite sick, he said that they generally died within a day or two, you know, so it's not super long drawn out. Now, they were able to provide those residents with, you know, morphine and lorazepam and comfort care medications and also oxygen, you know. So that was, you know, that was a route. So it is sad to think about, but I think if you have someone, you know, older in the home who knows that they wouldn't want to go if they were to get sick, you know, to actually just find out, you know, what would be your options for getting that clinical support, you know, to manage those symptoms in the home, to support you and the family, is something that can be worth thinking about. Or for somebody who's in a facility, it would be asking the facility, you know, like for residents who have decided that they don't want to go to the hospital, or, you know, ventilation, like, do they have a, you know, relationship with a hospice provider, or, you know, how are they supporting those residents? Okay. So Anonymous said, my dad decided to get his things in order because he may die. I completely understand that reaction. What I'm trying to understand is that now it's consuming his day. He's forgetting to live life. How do I encourage the live life part of his day? He's 89 and my mom is 86. Okay. So, yeah, well, I'll turn it over to the two of you. Have you had any experience with older adults who have gone this route, and what have you suggested or found is helpful?
Sorry, you, my domain of expertise.
Yeah. If they're engaging in longevity explorers, they're probably not, you know, in this state of mind. How about you, Dr. Nicole?
I think, you know, you might just need to allow him to do a bit of a coming to terms. You know, I mean, I think that my experience of some older people is that when they kind of think about end of life or get closer to end of life, there is that reflection. And, you know, that might be an important process for him to go to or to go through as well. So, you know, I think you can be supportive and be there for him and, you know, try to bring positive things to his attention, but it might be that he just needs to go through this and get to the other side. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I guess, you know, a couple things that I thought about for this was, first of all, I always think it's important to help the person feel heard and validated, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, one is, like, you know, be careful if what we're saying is, well, but you probably won't die, because maybe that's not what they want to hear right now. But the two things I think about is how much of this is being driven by just paying, maybe spending too much time listening to the news and media and kind of staying in a state of kind of fear. And if that seems to be driving it, is it possible to get them away from that? And then the other thing is to say, okay, you know, I hear you. You're taking this seriously. You're realizing this could be, you know, that there's a possibility of dying because of this in the next few months. How would you, given that time might be short, how would you like to spend this time? You know, and how can I like spend this time with you? Or how can we make this time meaningful? Right? I think there's an opportunity to sort of like, if you bring up that conversation, what comes up? You know, because it is what he's going to say is, well, then I just want to sit here in the corner, you know? I'm not sure they would, right? There might be an opportunity to sort of prompt them to sort of think about like, oh, what are the things that are most meaningful? Like, and you can even suggest some things like, you know, would it be helpful to call people, right? And make sure you had connections. You know, I think a little bit of some of the questions that, you know, are sometimes brought up at end of life on hospice, but like, is there anyone you need to talk to that you feel you want to resolve things with, you know? Are there some like, what was on your bucket list? Could we do some of these things virtually, right? Like find again, like the virtual tour, you know? But, you know, they say that sometimes when people get a terminal diagnosis, there's this opportunity for them to focus on what's most meaningful to them, right? And so, you know, I sort of think about like bringing that into the conversation, what would come out of that? And that might create some motivations and actually some really nice connections and activities within the family. Now, if the person is just staying scared or if they are having cognitive impairment and are kind of stuck, then it might be a little bit harder. But I think it would be worth, you know, before encouraging the live life part of his day, it's important to sort of make sure they're on board with wanting to do that, you know? And that's why I think sort of bringing up, oh, well, if these were your last like few weeks, how would you want to spend them? You know, are they really going to say glued to the news, reading the bad news? You know, maybe not. And maybe you can encourage them to think of other things. So that's what I would suggest there. I don't know if either of you have anything more you want to add.
Great.
Let's see, we have people sharing some helpful resources. So Deborah is mentioning the TrueLink Visa prepaid card. That is actually something we have a member in Helping Older Parents who's gotten that for her mom recently and is really happy with it. I'll share a link to that. It's a company I've known about for a while. They do have a special Visa card designed. I think the founder had an older relative who got scammed pretty badly. And so designed a card that could have more protections or allow another family member to monitor. So I think that's a good resource to share. Thank you for sharing that, Deborah. So I'm mindful that it's 2:30. Dr. Nicole and Richard, if either of you need to go, you can. We still have, let me see, we still have 65 participants. I can keep going for a while and answer a few more questions, but I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you both so much for staying. And if you can stay a little longer, please do. Sophia asked, what are the regulations, policies on advising caregivers and those in care work to work only with one elder rather than multiple and for them to shelter in place as part of their job? So I don't know if they have rules about this in Canada. In the States, we certainly do not have national rules. And I'm not even sure that most public health is often managed at the county level in the United States, which is a little bit crazy. I'm not even sure that most counties are issuing regulations. The CDC might have guidance, but I would start off, you know, by seeing what is the agency doing. Agencies are often creating policies for their workers, or some facilities will have policies. And that's actually turned into an issue because some facilities are saying, you know, there's coronavirus at a facility that the workers there, you know, can't work anywhere else, right? To not spread it. And that can create staffing shortages. So my understanding is that it has been mostly left up to individual agencies and facilities, but it's possible that in some areas, the local public health authorities have imposed a rule. And then the CDC just generally provides guidance. And I'm not sure that they have a policy about this in particular. So maybe related to this question, any suggestion for in-home healthcare agencies and workers? So again, the agency will come up with policies, but one thing that I think is plausibly very helpful is the idea of wearing the mask, right, when you come into people's homes. So I don't know if that's required anywhere, but I think that does have a lot of plausibility for reducing the risk of inadvertently transmitting it to the people around you. So would you have any other suggestions, Dr. Nicole, for just like, if one has to have paid caregivers coming into the home or coming in to assist an older person, what are ways to make that as safe as possible?
Yeah, so I think you're right. The policies do tend to vary according to the agency and then what type of care is being provided and how close you are. But I think if somebody is within 3 feet of a person and providing care, we would want them to wear a mask. So for sure, a surgical type mask. and probably also gloves. And then just using sort of those good precautions that people use in terms of changing them, doing hand hygiene. And that is, you know, part of the issue is the shortage of the, what they, you know, is called PPE, that personal protective equipment. So having another mask that you can put on, because a lot of providers would do many visits in a day, you know, and would work with many people. But I think that's probably the thing to do is to ask, you know, is this a new mask? If you have a store of equipment at your home, that might also be helpful to offer to the workers, or to wear a mask yourself, or put one on your older relative for the period of time that they're having that interaction. You know, that would probably be, that would be what I would recommend. But, you know, it's also important to check into what the policy is of the particular agency and what the public health recommendations are at the time. Mm-hmm. So,
And then someone, Bridget, asked, what are your thoughts regarding existing nursing home or elderly facilities that are building COVID-19 wings and allowing hospital, quote unquote, admissions to existing facilities?
Well, if they're kept in the wing, I mean, and in the hospitals, that they are sort of cohorting the people who are have confirmed COVID for sure, or mm-hmm. probable. So, it's if they can be kept separate to the people who are living in the facility, and if the staff is separate,
yeah,
that's probably, you know, it might help to keep the person safe, because it might mean that you, if you need the hospital, then you can go there, because mm-hmm. it'll have been diffused a bit.
Right. Yeah. And I think those are good suggestions. And I think it's so hard for us when we are the family and we have a loved one in a nursing home or facility, because first of all, we're not able to visit. We know they're kind of isolated and restricted, and we know it's a high risk situation in that there are outbreaks in these facilities, right? And once one starts, you know, it's easy for it to spread. And this is a group of people who are older and vulnerable and at higher risk. And even though many of them, you know, do get over it, that's what happened at that nursing home, you know, that was on Jerry Powell, you know, there's still like a 20%, you know, 10 or 20% chance that they might not. And that's extremely worrisome. And so I don't have a loved one in a facility, but if I did, of course, I'd be so worried. And I understand it. And I think it's important to realize that the facility has a lot of considerations and is under a lot of pressure. So they are scrambling and trying to keep their workers safe. They are trying to keep residents safe. They may not be doing everything they could or should be doing, but you know, they're doing what they can. And another, you know, and there are other considerations that have come up is that, first of all, they have residents who get sick, who go to the hospital, and who need to come back, right? You know, those might be long-term residents. And of course, you know, in a way, we'd prefer that nobody came in, you know, from the hospital. And, you know, that's, they're weighing, you know, the desire to keep their environment as coronavirus free with the reality that that older person has to come back to somewhere, and often, you know, would prefer to go back to where they were before. And then, you know, there's also a sort of monetary component, which is that many of these skilled nursing facilities, at least in the United States, have a combination of long-term residents and also short-stay patients who pay, you know, they get paid more for that. And that is part of how they, you know, economically run their facility. And so to completely stop mm-hmm. those short stays is a terrible economic cost to them. And they are, of course, you know, trying to stay afloat and be viable and pay their workers. So I think, you know, we have to accept a certain amount of imperfection. Even though that's very hard and scary, because of course we're usually focused on the person that we know and love and care about and want what's best for them. And I think the facilities realize that that's how everybody feels, and they are just doing a difficult job of weighing their multiple considerations. So yes, I would encourage you to keep in touch with them and ask them what they're doing, and you know, advocate for your older relative and be mindful that they, you know, they are dealing with a lot. They really, really are. So, um, So it's just a tough situation for everybody. So Ray asked, is viral load important or not? Dr. Nicole, what would you answer to that?
I don't know, like in an individual. Yeah, I don't, you know what? I haven't really read up on that too much. It might be that exposure matters, you know, so like getting, it might, the people who have full exposures to COVID like seem to get sicker with it rather than just one exposure to one person who has it. I haven't read up on that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't get full marks on my answer to that.
I feel like, you know, the bit I've read is that they think, first of all, the amount, it's hypothesized and it's plausible, you know, it's just not definitively confirmed, that the amount of what they call inoculum, the amount of virus that you get when you are exposed, is relevant to how likely you are to become symptomatically ill and how seriously ill. So again, when you are thinking about your safety or the safety of someone else, how unsafe is it? You know, it's important to consider, like, what is the risk of exposure and how much, right? So if you're in a grocery store where everybody's wearing the mask, they clean the store regularly, people are distancing, yes, there might be traces here and there, and it's overall, you know, a lower risk situation, right? Whereas if you go to the emergency room, either because you think you have coronavirus or you have something else requiring emergency care, I mean, people are still breaking legs, having heart attacks, and, you know, otherwise need to go to the emergency room. You know, that's an environment where it's much more likely that people, you know, are sick, right? And so the surrounding area is much higher. If you're a health provider and you're seeing people who have fever and cough, you know, that's high risk. And they are, you know, and when people are visibly sick, you know, if they have coronavirus, they'll be generating a lot of virus. So yes, you know, it is thought that like the kind of concentration of virus is relevant to how likely you are to catch it and then get very sick from it. Now, there's also a question of, you know, as people are actually sick, you know, could you follow their viral load and adjust treatment based on that or get prognostic information based on that? And I think that's, you know, mostly a research question for right now. But, you know, I think of viral load right now as more a question of, you know, as I'm considering, you know, the safety considerations. And, you know, is like, how likely is a certain situation to expose you to a lot of virus? And I think for the regular public, you know, potentially a higher virus situation would be if you have someone in the house who's sick, right? And either has been diagnosed with coronavirus or seems likely to have it, because we do have people who have that. I mean, right now, if you're sick from coronavirus, you're often told to, you know, stay at home, right? And try to ride it at home until you're very sick. And so for everyone else in the household, you know, yes, now you have a higher risk situation. And so that's when, you know, you want to be more careful. If you can get one of those closer fitting masks to keep you from getting it as you, you know, support your family member, that is when it's worth thinking about it. And it will make a difference if they cough in your face versus if you touch just like a teeny trace of something they touched, you know, in the house. So those would be my thoughts about viral load for right now. Okay, so Anonymous asked, my parents, age 101 and 97, are in assisted living. Should I be worried about infection? What can I do to keep them safe? I think we've covered a lot of that, right? yes, you know, it's reasonable to be worried, and I want to encourage everyone to just, you know, remind yourself to focus on, you know, what you can do and what you can control, you know, and asking about that. So what you can do to keep them safe is going to, again, depend on how the facility is you know, running things and what your parents are able and willing to do, I would say, right?
Here's a reminder.
Yeah. So, okay.
Hey, Leslie, I'm going to have to drop off.
Okay. Well, Richard, thank you so very much. So for everyone, I will post link to Richard's site, and Richard, actually, I think your longevity explorers have gone virtual, and you maybe are not able to take on lots of new ones right now, but there's will be a spot where people can sign up to learn more about it, right?
There is, if they want. Yes, we're trying virtual meetings instead of face-to-face at the moment.
So
and they're working very well.
All right. So we'll make sure we share that with everybody. Thank you so much for your time, Richard.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye. I'm just going to do a few more. And Dr. Nicole, stay if you can. And if not, I totally understand. So let's see. We still have 40 people.
6 o'clock yeah. my time.
We'll do just a few more and then we're going to wrap it up. Let me see if there's a question that we haven't yet answered.
One thing I did find was a good little decision aid to sort of help if you're in a retirement home and you're thinking that you should move out with family right now. What are sort of the things to think about?
That's
something
great.
I can share in notes for the group too.
Yeah, we can definitely. University of Ottawa. Yeah, so we can definitely post. Let me see. Is there a checklist that older adults could use to help walking them through some high-risk environments? I am not aware of one. We'll have to leave, but maybe we can answer a few more. I wanted to address the question of, is it safe to walk outside? I was wondering, maybe we'll make that one our last one. Because I saw that question come up in a lot of people's surveys, and I was just wondering, how are you helping people assess that? Because for those older people who want to go outside to get exercise, how safe is it?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of what we've already talked about is the risk versus benefit. Because we don't want someone to go out and get an injury. You know, if you've had more than one fall in the past 6 months, I would say that, you know, you might be more likely to fall. So I wouldn't want you to go out and potentially have a fall and need some attention. But if your walking is fairly stable, and you haven't fallen lately, then I think it's okay to go outside. You don't want to get, so imagine a dog leash, which is about 6 feet long. You want to keep other people a dog leash length away from you. And I think people understand. I notice when I go out to walk my dog, people will cross the street when they see me coming. It's not a scary looking dog. That's not why they're doing it. They're social distancing. So I think if you follow those practices, I think it is safe to go outside and it might do you some good. So I think just be sensible and just pace yourself and don't get in over your head. But yes, I think I would give permission to do a walk in your neighborhood.
I agree. I've generally been encouraging walking outside. Now, you raise a good point that, you know, be careful if you're at a high fall risk, because now, especially if there's a lot of coronavirus in your city, it's not a great time to go to the emergency room. if you had a fall. But I think, again, like managing that balance between, you know, being cautious and taking precautions and not getting too fearful. So, you know, what one person kind of posted was that they're afraid to walk outside because they heard that coronavirus can sort of linger in the air for, some time. And
It's not airborne at all.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to be airborne unless a droplet hits you in the face.
Well, sometimes they say it can aerosolize a little bit, but, you know, the person was also asking what to believe. And so what I was thinking about this is that, first of all, I think the media, even, you know, media that I consider reliable, right? So I consider something like the New York Times fairly reliable. They are looking for an interesting new twist on the story. So there will be someone who will like spritz an aerosolized coronavirus into a room as a study and say it was still there for 3, you know, hours. And that might, you know, become a headline or a blurb. But I think it's important to realize that, you know, we don't really know that people have caught it that way under real world circumstances. And so again, if you are going to impose for yourself or for your older parent an extremely strict standard of safety, you can do that, but that's costly, right? So again, you know, like Dr. Nicole started off at the beginning mentioning like the trade-offs. I want everybody to think about like, you know, what are the trade-offs? And often, a tiny bit of risk, additional risk, might be worth considering it in exchange for something, especially if you know that it's going to bring you a definite benefit. So for many people, walking outside, especially right now, is a pleasure, right? It is also good for your health. So that's a potential benefit, you know, maybe a little bit less of a definite benefit, but it's a potential benefit, you know, I think it's worthwhile, right?
Yeah.
So yes, you know, remember that it's going to be a very long time until we get to absolute safety, or just like being at the level of safety we had before, which was not even 100% safe. We were just sort of used to it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That generally probably walking outside, you know, should be fine. And so finding a way to sort of stay aware and keep up with the information and take precautions without getting too fearful or constricting ourselves too much or taking on too much burden. I think that's the challenge for many of us. And then of course, you know, coping with our worry and concern when we have loved ones who are in facilities and we're not able to connect with them the way we could, and we know they're at, you know, some bit of risk, of course, you know, in the facility, and we wish we weren't, you know, finding ways to just cope with that and redirect ourselves and support ourselves during this really unprecedented stressful time. So, okay, well, I want to thank those of you who are still here. We still have many people here, but I'm going to let Dr. Nicole go, and I need to go as well. I hope this was helpful to people. I always think it's fun to answer audience questions. I know Dr. Nicole does too, so this was super fun for us. We will be posting the audio of this as a podcast episode. We'll post the video for those who'd like to watch that kind of thing on the site, and we will share like all the related links and resources that we came up with. And otherwise, you can post your questions as comments on the site. You'll probably hear from Dr. Nicole, who's answering a lot of them for me these days. And then lastly, I want to say, if you are somebody with an aging parent, we also have our Helping Older Parents membership. It's closed right now, but we are going to be reopening next month. And so if you like getting answers from us, that's an opportunity. Or if you would like some extra guidance and support, especially during this time, that's an opportunity as well. So with that, I want to thank everybody. I'm going to wrap up the meeting. Take care, everyone. Take care. And we will be hopefully connecting with you again very soon. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.